Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the LSE. Welcome to this public lecture, which is about a book. We have copies. If you haven't already, they'll be available at the end. But it's not just about a book, it's about the topic of the book. It's about the subject of the book. It's about global business and globalization. My name is John Hughes. I'm a professor of practice in LSE Ideas. And now I'll give the plug for LSE Ideas. I was telling colleagues here, it's rated the second best university think tank in the world after some place called Harvard, whose resources are rather larger than the LSE, I can assure you. But there we are. At the end, there are feedback forms in front of you. We would very much appreciate it if you filled out those feedback forms. We have a very good reputation, and it's built on feedback, because it's what the customers say that is important to us. So please do fill them in at the end. Now, globalization is increasingly questioned in many parts, I shouldn't say many, in some parts of the world, the US and the UK possibly being two of those. But in other parts of the world, particularly I think China and India, where it's lifted tens of millions of people out of poverty, the view is rather different. So it's a topic that we need to discuss, particularly in light of perhaps the election yesterday in the United States, where President Trump shows no sign of resigning, and the American people, in some senses, no sense of resigning from what he wants to do. Question is, what is global business? Is it just for big firms? How does it operate? How does it operate today? How should it operate? How will it operate tomorrow? These are the sort of questions that this book looks at, and our principal speaker, Mahesh Joshi, will be giving a talk for about 30 minutes. And then Anne-Marie Giuliano will have a dialogue with him about the book, as indeed with one of his teachers, if I may say so, on my left, Dr. Joffrey. So that what we have is a dialogue, and then I'll open it up so you are involved in the dialogue. We don't want you to just be on the receiving end of this. We want you to participate in it with us. And if I have a chance, I might ask a question or two as well. There we are. If you want to tweet, there's the hashtag Joshi, hashtag global business. And I think that's all I need to say, but I'll hand over to Mahesh.
Thank you. You can ask the question, but you won't grade me this time.
Yeah.
That's what we all used to be worried studying here, that how we can get graded. So welcome, good evening, everybody. And we try pretty hard to keep a ratio of at least one speaker to three people, and looks like we succeeded. We would have tried to go to one for two. I have a rule that if I see the audience is smarter than me, I have the better panel members who can answer the questions. So now you see I've got good support here. So going ahead, let me talk to you about our book. What I'm going to discuss today in the next few minutes is three important topics. One, you can call it globalization, globalism, or the global business or international trade. What it has given us in the last few decades? What's one important thing where it has impacted us, all of us? And then second, I'll talk about the present situation. And it's pretty dicey. Present has become already past. Things are moving so fast, but the future is not right. And what's the future? So I'll give a glimpse of future, because nobody can predict what the future is going to be. So this is how the whole discussion has been laid out. And you see, these are the panel members. And I'll start with this profound statement that 7 decades of unprecedented peace since 1945, what has happened? It's relatively peace. It's not as bad as it used to be in the past. Why it has happened? What has contributed that? Is it the increase in number of stable democracies? Or is it because of the business? Is it a commercial peace? If you look at the research of our friend John O'Neill and Bruce, they very clearly say that if 2 countries are trading in a given year, there's a very little chance that next year they will have militarized kind of any conflict. It's not going to happen. So you can call it a liberal peace. They're not going to fight. And we all know that democracies normally don't fight with each other. Also, if you look, Steven Pinker, he has also commented, and there is a nice research he did, and he conveys in his book, The Better of Our Nature, Value of Our Nature, the declining conflicts. He's also committing it to, one of the factors for him also is stable democracies, but he's talking liberal peace or capitalistic peace, that capital is getting you to peace. I'll just walk you through some of the numbers, because I know you always have to get some numbers in LSE to prove a point. But although nowadays the numbers can be manipulated, this is not manipulated. There is a source there. So if you go back 200 years, what has happened in democracies from 1800s? Relatively flat, it was autocracies which were ruling till a long time. And then suddenly, if you see close to the Second World War, the democracies went down when they were getting a small growth. And what triggered it? The young democracies moved away during the time of war. They became autocracies. And then came a time when autocracies took off. So if you look at, this is the inflection point during the Second World War when democracies went down. And now see the next change point, the fall of Soviet Union. After that, there was a trigger point where a lot of democratization happened, and although the number of countries had also gone up by then. If you go to the extreme right of the curve, you will see green at the top. Now, is that what has created peace? That's one. Now, you convert into the number of people living in various regimes. The green is democracies. So almost 1 in 2 person in the world today is living in a democracy, in the green zone. You go to autocracy at the top in red, 4 out of 5 people are living in China out of that. Right? Now, I forgot to mention in the earlier one, which you see here, anocracy, which is somewhere in between, you see, you can't predict them much, but the 2 noted behaviors of democracies you can see there. Now, if you overlay on that, what is business doing? You can see in the last 40 years, or since 1960, how the trade as a percentage of GDP moved. That could be a measure of what is happening. So could that be the reason that the global business, beyond creating wealth and prosperity, is also contributing towards peace? So that's the premise which we are looking at. Now I'll move you how it has come, what is happening in the global business. If you all agree that, yes, it is contributing to the peace mission also. But is it the purveyor of peace? Now, in global business, as you will see in the book, who is it for? Well, it is for a housewife sitting in Kenya who's cutting flowers and it's being exported to Europe. That's global business. She's making money, whatever livelihood she's getting out of it. On the other hand, you can see there is a political rhetoric there and somebody is fighting elections on the basis of that. And that's in the United States of America. Then you say, okay, we'll put tariff on you. We'll constrict your capability to do business with us because you're behaving differently. So the global business in that sense is affecting both. From a simple housewife sitting in Africa somewhere to the guy who's running the largest democracy in the world, whose GDP is the highest. So it impacts everybody. So there's a full swing of pendulum there. Next, you want to see who is it impacting global business. Is it impacting local business, or local businesses are becoming part of global business? Now, in today's environment with technology in the play, there's a lot of interconnectedness. Amazon can take anything from anywhere. You may be sitting in a small town anywhere in UK, or you're sitting in a small village in China, you're sitting in Yantai, you can ship your material on either Alibaba or you can ship on Amazon. Next day, it gets delivered. So local, if it wants to remain local, can be boutique, but it has an opportunity now to become part of a bigger business, which is global. So you go global overnight as you become part of a global business. And global businesses benefit from local businesses. So how that is happening? Now, you would see China was the biggest exporter of textile, shoe uppers, all this kind of stuff. Where is it going now? You'll find in Vietnam, you'll find in Bangladesh, Mozambique, small countries. Who's finding those local businesses? The global businesses are going and finding those small businesses. Both are gaining. What's happening to prosperity? Yeah, wealth creation is there, prosperity is there. But yeah, there is poverty elevation. China claims since the reforms, they have pulled several hundred million people out of poverty. Well, what's the downside of that? Although it's good, you've got people out of poverty, inequality has improved. Inequality has gone bad, sorry, it has not improved. A lot of inequality has come, a lot of wealth has gone in the hands of very few people. That's a negative. But now, how do you look at it? If you have somebody claiming have close to a million people globally come out of poverty, is that more important or inequality is more important? Maybe somewhere in between, because inequality is also not good. It can create social unrest. It can cause a lot of anarchy in the system. What has happened to the technology? How it has contributed? We all know internet. So that's the play of technology there. Leadership is totally different. All the old models are gone now. The communication module for leaders are so different. You cannot have a communication which you think will reach somebody within a week. The social media is so strong. The leaders in business as well as in countries get judged in seconds in social media. So the leadership model of the past are totally out. All the old system is gone. So the leadership is under tremendous pressure to always perform, always remain on the right standards, because you can be judged socially very quickly. Now, what has happened in 21st century now, if you look at how much of transition has happened? There were a lot of emerging economies. Now, where are those emerging economies? People used to talk about BRICS. Now, BRICS fund has been closed down by Goldman Sachs. They made tons of money, 2012. Did BRIC fall apart? Probably not. Some of them did very well. So you know about what happened to India, what happened to China in terms of GDP, PPP. 2015, China became number one. But with purchasing power parity, and India became number three. They were nowhere close to when, in 2001, Jim O'Neill, when he started the concept of a fund which was called BRICS. Now, those emerging economies of those times have become new economic powers. Now, how they became economic powers is not the same route. China took the stage as manufacturing. India took the route of knowledge barons. They created the knowledge economy there. So there's no one way to become a new economic power, but now we really have new economic powers. You are seeing how the United States is responding to one of the new economic powers. And what happened to the natural resources? And how they have created the transition. Okay, so oil and gas, a lot of green energy is being talked about, still very important. Still it is not going to die down because the emerging economies. A lot of people in emerging economies have been pulled from rural economy to urban. There's a lot of middle class now as the private sector, as the people from poverty, from rural moved into urban, their demands are growing up. It's not only the electric cars which are going to solve the energy problems, the natural resources, mining, extractive industry, all of them, oil and gas, they're all needed now. But there is a changing equation there. In oil and gas itself, you're so dependent on certain countries. Now suddenly US comes, uses the technology, comes into the shale play, uses technology again, and reduces the cost of oil. The rule of not exporting any crude oil from US changes because they have so much of it. What do you do with that? They were the ones who were the masters of creating the whole value chain and keeping the maximum value with them, selling their end product, refining it. The rest of the industry which is there gets more impact of oil and gas going up and down. And that creates waves in the global business. Now, what is happening? Now, there is an upheaval here, which is happening. Where is the business growth coming from? You saw one large company suddenly going down as if there's no tomorrow, called General Electric, whose market cap at one point of time was more than $400 billion, now $100 billion. Thomas Alva Edison, do you need anybody better than that to start a company with that innovative mindset? But what went wrong? We're not going to decipher GE for now. Overall in business model, there were many GEs which were in play, conventional industries. But what happened was they set their process, their own way of doing things. Suddenly there is an onslaught of startup culture where idea is king. So the economic foundation, the economic theories used to say, what, labor, land, and capital. Do you really need it now? Any one of this room can start a business tomorrow and can be very successful, like any one of them. It became people, idea, and things. Capital became easily available. You have multiple channels. We'll talk about that. So the growth in business came from somewhere else. If you look back, just 2011, beginning of this decade, top five companies by market cap, only one was from new kind of industries, which was Apple. The rest was who? The oil barons, Exxon, the Shell, the ICBCs, and another oil company. That's about it, China Petroleum. Who are today in 2016 when the flip happened? All five were, you can call them IT industry. The new word for them is the distractive industry. They create distraction, like Facebook is a distraction, WhatsApp is a distraction. It's Amazon, it's Microsoft there, it's Apple there now, it's Alphabet there. So all Facebook, they became what market cap? Touching close to a trillion. So sudden change, where are the growth drivers now? The job creation moved away from conventional industry. U.S. has a statistics, because they measure a lot, everything, that the net positive job creation in U.S. came only because of the new industries, which were mostly startups 20 years ago. The conventional industry had minus 2.5% or so, I don't remember the exact number, job decline. So that is a big change. If you look at what's happening in geopolitics here, there's a lot of uncertainty there. You see, we talk about Brexit, we talk about what happened in US. That is related to the second point also, seeking truth from facts. I'll address both together. There's a lot of data. We can consider data as the fact, but is that the truth? So data analytics became so strong that how do you visualize that data to pick up the truth out of this plethora of data which you have, which you can see as facts. When you look at statistics, we think data is fact. But how do you seek the truth out of it? Nobody predicted Brexit as accurately as what happened. Nobody predicted Trump to win till the last moment. Every data point was showing something else, if you call it fact. There were relaxation in the other camps that maybe Trump will never win, but that did happen. So these two things are going hand in hand now, that geopolitical uncertainty is created because of these. These were not the only reason data. The main reason was the inequality which came in earlier, which you talked about, the left behind people were unhappy that everybody was not getting the same share of the prosperity and wealth which is coming in. That reflected in them being upset with the whole society. They said, okay, let me try something new. But the data should have picked up. It didn't pick up. Now, let's look at the future. So you heard about that, who moved my cheese? I use the same, who moved my work? So what's happening to the workforce? I talked about conventional industry. So what was happening in the past, which is saying now, and some of us knew that first 21 years of your life, you're learning, you're going to education, then you start earning, you earn well, leverage that knowledge, then you retired, enjoyed the money. Can you do it now? Absolutely not. The time frame of relearning used to be 20 years and became 10. Now what they say is come close to 4. And probably, I'd say, educational institutions will confirm that executive education is the fastest growing, you can't call it industry, is whatever you name it, is the piece where everybody's going for. Because if you don't retool, you are irrelevant very quickly. So how do you go to a premier institution like LSE or Oxford or Harvard, whatever you call, but still remain relevant? Would you be relevant if you studied 21 years, put in it, and you were in a conventional job? No more. It used to happen. All the data is indicating it's not happening. And jobs are moving pretty fast. I'll give you one example. Anne and I, we were talking about car industry. Now, you used to have drivers, taxi drivers. Stable job. I'm a cab driver. I picked up one job. So I can be there for 30 years, know my route very clearly, no GPS needed. I know how to deal with my passengers. Suddenly comes Uber. Doesn't have a car. Doesn't have a driver. Doesn't have a payment mechanism. Doesn't have even the GPS. But they're benefiting it. But who's driving it? Any of us can spend an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening. Now you have going back from home. Here's a driver. So what happens to the conventional taxi driver? So a lot of such changes. Now, take it on the other part of it, combined with the second one. So what's going to happen to human in post-AI world? Reflection is here. That suppose I had to pick up a component put in this phone, and I'm an assembler. How do you think my efficiency would be for this motion in 12 hours if it gets replaced by a robot? Mine will be less. My accuracy will go down. I can always increase the speed of the MI here. So now machine intelligence is coming in. So that's changing totally the way the work was being done in the past. And you will see more of it. I'll give you one very good example. If you read, if you Google, that computers were once people. Computers were not a machine. Till, if you see in Second World War, mostly it was counted as kilo girl hour, kilo girls. Because most of the men went to the war in Second World War, and the calculation, the statistics, the math was being done by ladies in a room. And that room was called computer. And all the people doing were called computers. Now, what is computer now? It's a machine. And similarly, Katherine Johnson, who just got celebrated, she was sitting at NASA calculating manually how the capsule will land and where. She would work backwards. John Glenn, when he was going to space, when he got the data from a computer, he went to her, asking her this question to Katherine Johnson, that, can you tell me, is this calculation correct? So those were human beings, not very long ago, 60, 70 years ago. So that has been replaced by computer. You never know what all will be replaced. So what will survive will be only deep work and deep thinking. So a human being will not be doing repetitive tasks, which is happening already. If you open your Gmail, some of the answers come at the bottom now, depending on what somebody's asking you. Do you want to meet in the evening? You want to do something else? So AI is already in play, and they're controlling you. And about the future of globalization. Now, how many people are buying on internet? 100 million, maybe more, 300 million? How many million people are going across the border for work every day? Several million people are going. Now, how many people are getting material shipped across the borders? Can state control the march of globalization or accelerate it? Or it is already gone into the hands of non-state actors, non-state good actors, the industries, the Apples, the Amazons, the Alibabas of the world. I don't have exact answers for that, but if you look at it, they have started controlling it. There are no rules on it. If you go from 1991, the early 90s to late 90s, the internet was growing very fast. The U.S. economy was growing fast. If you ask Bill Clinton why this happened, probably the answer would come, he would be happy with economic growth. But there was no way to regulate it. Nobody knew how to regulate it. There were no rules around it. The rules came in once they had an issue. Right? Now if you look at the conventional business, where they went wrong, or why they could not grow as fast as the non-conventional business, because it was an idea. Anything, the new enterprise, the entrepreneurship, is an idea which is being supported by people. It's no one bank betting all the money and losing everything. You can do crowdsourcing. Young kids do crowdfunding. They don't even think twice about it. They'll go on online and get the funding done. See that model, and now you go to the GE way of doing things, or a company XYZ way of doing things. Your process is in place. You're only one way of doing things in place. So once your process is in place, one way of doing things in place, what are you promoting? You're not promoting innovation. You're not promoting anybody who's coming with a new idea, because he has to follow that process. Unless you're changing their process very quickly, it is mediocrity. Because somebody who can follow the process, because process will drive the results. Whereas if you look at the success of the companies which are the top five by market cap, Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, Facebook. They're all startups at some point of time. Take Microsoft back to 80s, but rest were probably 90s. Apple also came into its elements in 90s. What is one common factor? Almost no rules. It was new ideas. Then they started putting ideas around that idea and kept building it. So you have to unleash the human innovative mind by not putting process in place many a time. But in the past, it was the processes which were giving you results. So people followed it. So that's a huge change. Is that going to affect the future of globalization? Can the past rules be brought in place? I don't have the answer, but I have the right guy to answer it. The guy who talks a lot across the globe out of Oxford on what is the future of globalization. So I'll end here and I'll let it move in the next slot.
Right. Anne-Marie.
Hi. Thank you. I found a lot of the topics in this book very relevant to what I do on a day-to-day basis. I work with a lot of startups and small businesses here in the UK. And I think just to what resonates to me is when you talk about local becoming part of global, and then that interrelationship of what impact actually politics has on the small businesses that are global. So a good example, one of my clients is a makeup business here in the UK that sources their products from China and Australia with clients in the US and Europe. And she got started by doing makeup in Ibiza. So I think you would call that quite global. She has a small group, maybe a handful of people that work with her to help her execute her trade. And so when I look at this example and look at how fast she's growing as a business, and kind of really resonates with your point of these businesses that are able to take an idea and kind of really grow quickly, what impact does the political structure have on her business? And what are the boundaries she might face with now, what is a complex environment? And if you have, what type of regulation can impact or will impact these type of businesses that come in from the US or that might come in from China? So I think it's interesting to think about and would love to get your thoughts with regards to that. There's, beyond that also, when you look at, you highlight inequality within the growth of inequality, and that only a small number of individuals are getting a lot of the wealth. A lot of discussion has been around taxation and the ability for these large institutions that you highlight that are so successful that don't play by the rules. And historically, taxation allowed the businesses to help fund for local infrastructure. Well, now you have these large companies that are operating out of effectively tax havens so that they don't have to give back to the local economy. And how is that really going to play out? How much time do we really have globally to be able to put up with that? And at what point does it become more crucial that these type of institutions are governed, or do they govern themselves? And so I'm interested in kind of on the thoughts around that as well.
Okay.
I think both are very relevant points. And again, the first one, what technology has done is it has made the globe as a boundaryless world. Mm-hmm. Now, as things progress, now organizations like WTO or you can take even countries, the states can put their boundaries, but are they willing to? Are they nimble enough to put it before the business moves to the next step? Because right now what is happening in global business, things are moving so fast that the organization we're supposed to regulate are not able to even catch up with them. If they could find a mechanism, or probably they put some thought ahead of times and they were driving it, they could put some boundaries on that. Chances in my thought process to control and regulate probably is not as strong as it should be. So it may not happen. Unless the geopolitics takes a very different stage where the states decide that we are absolutely anti-globalism. We will not allow ourselves or our businesses, which I named as non-state actors, all the big companies, and control them. Chances I see are very little, because the impact on the overall environment would be pretty devastating. And on your second point, on that was more about the taxation and all that. Finance can create rules around it, but I still feel that they will also face the same issues, because the modus operandi of tax havens may change differently. Now, as we all heard in the United States, when Mr. Trump reduced the taxes, he could pull some money back. So now everybody can start doing it. My take on that is, it is not the companies which compete on taxes, that they go to the low tax areas. It is the countries which compete on taxation. They put low tax or high tax. So I would let go companies out of it that they have an office at one place or a company registered somewhere else. It's not their problem. Because they are there, they have social responsibility, definitely, but they have to make money also. And they have competitive forces to deal with. It's the countries which are competing on the tax structures.
I wonder if I can push back on that one. In the book you say, and by the way, it's a joint book with JR. JR Klein is sitting over there, so let me acknowledge JR. I mean, in the book you said, companies that want to be around for decades to come must ensure that society is at the heart of everything they do. But you also say, as you've just said, about tax havens, control here lies with governments, and business cannot be blamed for taking advantage of competitive jurisdictional tax structures. So in other words, if you want to be a firm that's going to be around for decades, and society is the heart of what you do, how then can you defend tax havens? Because the other way, if you want to be part of a society, you have to pay tax in that society. And what is happening now is many of these multinationals do not pay tax in that society. So it's not just a problem of governments, it's a problem of the ethics of the firms that you're arguing for.
And that's a very good point. So let me put it in two different perspectives. One is, yes, tax. Money coming in, government using for social benefit. So now companies are also defining the purpose for themselves.
Yeah.
And their mission and vision statements as corporate social responsibility, taking up in a big way that how do they contribute to society. I'm not trying to defend that they should not pay tax by saying that. So they're doing their little bit to pay to the society. But if the tax structures were such that the companies were willing to pay the tax, could be the answer to that. So the tax havens which have been created, you know, the companies, suppose there's a company in US, but they register somewhere else. If they get the equivalent benefit, not exactly the same, a reasonable amount, like the way money is moving back to US now, there could be a compromise solution in between.
I find it an interesting topic, because also like one of the points you highlight is the fact that leadership is judged socially and very quickly. And there's, I would think there's got to be an inflection point quite soon, or as the inequality continues to grow, there will be an inflection point where it's no longer socially acceptable that Apple does not pay more for the areas that they're operating in. You kind of see it a little bit with, Amazon in the U.S. Has tried to, when they're looking at the next city, has tried to put in a lot of infrastructure to help that city. But then on the other side, the city's doing a lot for Amazon to get their business. So how much is it really going to contribute is debatable. But I guess the point being that there should be some additional pressure put on these companies socially, so that it's not socially acceptable to not give back to the community. And then, of course, I agree with you. There's always going to be someone looking for the better deal, and the better deal is where you find that tax haven. That's where governments should come together. If you don't have the tax arbitrage, then you're not going to have that, and then you're able to give back and reduce that inequality.
I totally agree with you. The next biggest issue would be inequality. Because, okay, there is a stage where you can pull people out of poverty. A lot of developing economies have done it. But beyond that, even in those geographies, if this inequality where they pull people into out of poverty, it doesn't reduce, you can have social unrest. So this will be the biggest challenge to face or to figure out how to solve that problem.
Thank you, John and Ed and Mahesh. First of all, congratulations for putting this book together, and pretty sort of smart summary, I should say. I mean, you've taken in hand the theme, global business, which is as complex as talking about humanity. I mean, you can run this seminar for hours and days and months and years, and you would never come to any kind of conclusion. So when I was leaving my school this afternoon, I said, aha, this is going to be my day. Mahesh and JR used to challenge me during the program, and now I'm going to challenge Mahesh. Are you ready?
Absolutely. You've been trained by the best.
So actually, I find it very difficult to challenge what you and John have said in the last 2-3 minutes. Fundamentally, global business will only make sense if the society is at the center of the global business. I mean, the global business as it is today just cannot continue. It's the most unregulated human-made phenomenon. You talked about removing the tax arbitrage. You talked about removing all the tax differentials. You talked about people coming at the high table, all the corporate leaders. Who doesn't meet at Davos and pass all types of judgment on each other and then come out with a social agenda? But by the time they're back in their office, everybody forgets that social agenda charted at Davos. So we humanity just cannot face the consequences of this unregulated phenomenon called global business. Let me work through some of the observations. By the way, I'm a completely ideology-free academic. I'm neither for right-wing, nor for the left-wing, nor anywhere in the middle, because I take research from a more neutral perspective. And let me just highlight some of the inequalities that you mentioned, and John and Mahesh. A recent report has indicated that the very essence of globalization in Indian context, which started way back in 1991 until 2015, more than 80% of the wealth has gone into the hands of crony capitalists. And we already see the consequences of that. There is so much unreported social unrest in that country that there is so much environmental damage. The unions have been completely wiped out in many industry sectors. Nobody has none of the sort of representations of the society have any voice against these crony capitalists and their political allies. And we also see the sort of wave of right-wing political leadership coming into the political office. That is bad for the countries which are still at a stage where they have to take care of hundreds of billions of people who have no access to water or electricity or nutrition or health. To take another example, I don't know how many of you have been to Bangalore or Hyderabad. There are thousands of IT workers who are now looking for their next meal because they have been thrown out from their software writing work which they were doing for some of the five big companies that you mentioned, Mahesh. The founders of those companies are amongst the most powerful people today. And are they happy to listen to those thousands of software writers who actually made them what they are today? Is that the kind of disparity that you want to create by being the top five companies in the world? Isn't there a sense of captaincy or the kind of responsible leadership that we are talking about? And some of them have become so powerful. I was reading yesterday in Financial Times that a group of seven countries wanted to convene one of the captains of these five companies to come and face the music for what they have done in terms of the leakage of personal data, and this guy is unwilling to come. He said, I've done my work by appearing before the US and the Netherlands, the UK, a couple of other countries are just left high and dry waiting for this guy. I mean, that's the shift of power that we are talking about. Let me pick some more examples. Again, I'm not blaming the leaders from the Western world. I go to Bangladesh in Dhaka. There are hundreds of these factories where they make the ready-made garments. The workers work under appalling conditions. You and I wear those clothes when we go to Marks and Spencer or wherever. The owners of those companies buy real estate in Chelsea to secure their future, just in case things go wrong in Bangladesh. So that's another shade of globalization that we are talking about. So the question is that who is winning? Who has won the globalization 1 or 1.5, whatever you want to call it? Right? That's one question to address. And I'm glad that all of you pointed out towards the inequality. Then you talked about the local versus global. You drew a very sort of positive picture on that. I have a slightly different opinion on that, and it's based on my research in the field of biochemistry and pharmaceuticals. The last 10 years have seen a massive increase in the number of collaborative R&D projects between the American and the European pharmaceutical giants, and research and development companies in the developing countries. And one of the rationale for this kind of collaboration is that in many developing countries, you have the same level of expertise that you will find in United States or UK or Germany or France, but at one-tenth the cost. The drug trial mechanisms are softer, and therefore it makes much more sense, not purely from the economics of R&D, but also from the speed of entry into the market, that you will develop these kind of R&D collaborations. But what happens once the patents have been registered? Do we see those drugs in the developing countries? We only see those drugs, whether they are meant for fighting cancer or they are meant for fighting Alzheimer's, in the Western world. And the moment a patient asks for those drugs in the developing countries, suddenly you find that the cost is 40 times. So where is the sort of sense of balance in terms of the participation of local companies versus the global companies? So that's another point that we need to look at. Let me address another point that you mentioned about technology. Many of you would know that India has been trying to negotiate a free trade agreement with European Union for the last about 10 years. Europe wants to push their fashions, wines, and expensive cars. That's not India's priority. India's priority is technology. India's priority is more work permits for the engineers, the fantastic engineers that they produce. So what is happening in the field of technology? Again, what we find is that in the field of health and education, the technology gap has been widening across the developed countries and the developing countries. And often we are told that, look, you can't afford these technologies. These technologies are beyond your application expertise, etc. All kinds of excuses are there. Of course, there are some noble companies within the sort of gray area that I'm referring to. But again, whatever we might say, I mean, World Bank spins a pitch that because of globalization, the technology gap has reduced. Not true. The specific sector data presents a very different picture altogether. You talked about leadership. So my non-speculative take on this is that when you walk into the next phase of globalization, you would need leaders who believe in the sense of mutuality, which is not just based on commercial complementarities, not just based on value chain complementarities, but also mutuality in terms of the outcomes. One of the reasons that we see so much negative evidence about globalization is that it has focused mainly on the results, not on the impacts. Whereas what is important today is the impact on the society. Leaders who focus on citizens and people who are the ultimate beneficiaries of globalization and not just the corporations. That's the other take that I have. And finally, leaders who will go beyond the national rhetoric. And of course, we can go on and on and on. And I was sharing with John and the colleagues on the panel that the Western world needs to understand that they are no longer going to be the center of globalization, the fulcrum, the focal point, and the power structures of the globalization are definitely shifting away. And although it's going to be very messy, the Western world will make it even more difficult because nobody wants to lose the power, but it's going to happen. That's what I would say.
Mahesh.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's challenging times. And we see rise of populism. And that could be, that could trigger a kind of crisis for globalization. But how far will it go beyond the personal gains of some of the regimes? That needs to be seen. So overall, if you look at the total impact of it to the society, inequality on the negative side, rest of it, technology improvement, lifestyle improvement, is it going to all of them? Not. But the number of people getting benefited as compared to, 60 years ago, 40 years ago, yes. So there is some positive trajectory in it. There could be some hiccups on the way. But overall, the direction right now seems positive, unless something dramatic happens from now on. But you're right, you can't deny there is an inequality. Some people are just...
Do you think that the growth of technology related businesses are unaffected by populism? So you can have a very closed down state, but you can operate globally because you're connected.
If the connection is not restricted, if the populism just restricts, if there are geographical restrictions for the non-state actors, in this case our companies, it will restrict innovation also. For innovation thrives only in open environment. So the one of the biggest advantages of globalization or global business has been what? Leveraging the best resources wherever they are available. So I may not have the best, let's say I'm a manufacturer. I don't have the best machining capability. So I can go to geography A. But I don't have the best raw material also. I can go to geography B. So take material from B, give it to A. But I know how to assemble it the best. So that is the power of globalization, the division of labor to the most suited person or the resource you can do.
My problem with this observation is that it's once again designed for the benefit of a corporation. And complete disregard to the impact on the society.
So, okay, if that's the point, let me put it this way. Just to see, when you send a satellite up, for some reason, that helps humanity. All right? So now if you send from the United States of America, it costs you X. If you send from a low-cost country, which is benefiting, because of technology transfer, open channels, it's very different. Now, it is not only benefiting that low-cost geography, it is affecting the high-cost geographies also. Give an example in this case. Let's say the Mars orbiter, which India launched, poor country, no cost. How much? Less than the production cost of a movie called Gravity. Less than $100 million. And see, what it gave them is a capability to launch next 100 satellites in one go. Benefiting who? Russia, benefiting America, benefiting African countries, benefiting somebody else. So the way I will put it is, there is a positive, there is a negative. It's a mix of both. It is not a gloom or doom situation. At the same time, it is not the most acceptable situation in terms of inequality and how the society is getting impacted. My personal view is pulling X number of people out of poverty is very important. Whether it is done by, it's a job of state in a way, to invest into it, to pull them. But if a non-state actor does, there's nothing wrong with it, right? If you say China could have done on themselves, but they actually did it. The state invested into urbanization, state invested into business. But some other countries allowed the non-state actors to flourish there and help the society. Now, I'm not saying they are doing everything right to manage the society well, but there is a right balance somewhere. It cannot go one way or the other.
Okay, we started the debate. Now it's up to you to continue it. We'll open up to questions. Could I ask you to wait until we've got a lady there who's going to, a student of social policy, who's going to hand the mic around. So if you raise your hand and wait for the mic and then state your name, ask a concise question, a concise comment. Gentleman over on the left.
Thanks very much. Is that it? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I had a long career with ExxonMobil, which was one of the products of Standard Oil. And when you talk about crony capitalism, and you go back to about 1910 in the US, the way that Standard Oil was broken up was by national politics decreeing that it must happen. It's national politics that has to resolve the issues of people who are losers in Tyneside or in Detroit within those two countries. And our politicians have done a poor job of adjusting those things. So I agree with you that, of course, there are winners and there are net winners because of your graph that we've seen before. The problem is we're not doing a good job, even nationally, of adjusting the benefits for the people who aren't winners at this stage. But if that's the case, how are we going to do this internationally? And now you're talking about your Fangs and all these guys who are benefiting massively here at the expense, or your farmer or whatever it is, of these other people in other countries. To get some sort of group that will adjust the benefits across countries has to be done collectively. And so here's my key point. It's all about politics. Business will take care of itself. And we're not breeding good politicians. We're breeding worse politicians, even on a national basis. So if that's a problem, how bad is it going to be internationally? And my last point on this, sorry, I get passionate about this, is that we're very complacent, and we can see this come to a halt. That graph can go into reverse. If you look at the market share of world trade of China in about 17, 18, 90, they went from 25% of world market share to 2% in about 60 or 70 years. It can happen. So how do we breed? And there's my question. How do we breed and get recognition for the need to breed new polls, politicians who will do the job we need?
I think we have to let the leaders come and study at LSE.
Let me respond to this. I have at least two or three leaders in mind when I'm responding to this. All of these leaders who are siding with, supporting the crony capitalism and the more right-wing politics, they have been legitimized by the other global leaders. So there are no national politicians in some countries anymore. I mean, we have examples of leaders who have come into power through false promises and rhetoric, and if you talk to people heart to heart, they will say, oh no, come on, I just hate you. But then the moment you see that there is a big market opportunity, all the global leaders come and you know, they start to open up the doors to their investments and their whatever you have, and suddenly you create a face which is not a national politician but a global politician. So politics itself is getting globalized. And it is very difficult for society to sort of teach such politicians a lesson in a short time. Unless there is a massive churn, and that we are going to see. So 1910 was different. Messages were not traveling that far. You were not traveling very fast. Today, every embrace that a rogue politician offers to another powerful global leader gets stretched everywhere. And that legitimizes him or her. That's the problem.
I just want to share two thoughts on it. One, in the business context, as the technology has evolved, a lot of things have changed, social media and all that. A lot of people working different locations, you're managing global teams. You would have heard that term now. It's coming from control junkie to chaos monkey. Because chaos monkeys are becoming experts at how to manage the chaos. It's chaos every day. That's on the business side. On the political side, you would have seen, in terms of populism, is there a positive strain in this when they say, made in America, is it good or bad? I don't know, I'm just commenting on it. So if you make in America, who's going to benefit? Okay. Somebody saying make in India, like Modi came into power, he said that. I'm not giving any comment. Is it good or bad for the society? Now you look at Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has started this huge initiative for in-kingdom total value addition called Ictiva. And so Aramco, you can't sell, that's the largest company, if you're not assembling there. Is it good for the company and people, country and people there or not? So I would say this book, is maybe if I have to position it, I would say it's not a floodlight on the subject. It's more of you're walking with a torch, you're picking something, understanding, generating more curiosity as it is happening right now. And that's the best part of this book.
Okay, thank you very much. Another question. I think it was a question over there, wasn't it?
One of the points raised was that...
could you say your name, please?
My name is Yuri. So one of the points raised was that a lot of people are going out of job in Bangalore because they are not able to reskill themselves, and somehow it's the responsibility of the companies to take care of them. How about looking at this way, that the same people took jobs from Americans and Europeans in call centers and in, let's say, low value IT, you know, systems or technologies. And now, I mean, thing is coming full circle now with AI and other such technologies, data sciences. A lot less people are needed to generate an end-to-end, you know, software solution. But then it falls the responsibility of retraining yourself or acknowledging a need to, you know, get ready for the next wave falls on an individual, not on the company. You know, how would you guys look at that? Do you reckon that in the future, I mean, maybe these people that, I mean, people that have been laid off, maybe they might come up with new startup ideas in India that are very India specific, mm-hmm. and maybe they might trigger a new wave of you know, global companies.
So you obviously have a very good understanding. Let's go back to the days when the Bangalore and Hyderabad were laying the foundations for the information technology software parks. What is the expectation of all the founders of these companies that the Indian government will support the IT industry? And they were getting huge amount of tech subsidies, land at a subsidized rate, everything was given to them.
I think so the Indian politicians were dumb enough that they didn't even know how to tax this industry.
Often said that, but the truth is that a lot of founders of the Indian software companies were able to develop the sense of, you know, growing the millions and the billions because they were getting massive amounts of taxpayers' money support. Now that you have taken that support, when things are not going so well for you, what is the responsibility? Is the taxpayer again going to help you? Is it such an unending handicap on the part of the corporation that they will never come forward? I mean, you talk in terms of the billionaires of the world. What's the value of a billionaire if the very guys who laid the foundations of your company are going without a meal? Of course, the unattached curiosity of those young people will put them somewhere in the future. Pretty optimistic about it. But the fact of the matter is that what we see today is a situation which is absolutely, from a point of view of the responsibility of the very founders of the businesses on the Indian side and in the Silicon Valley, is a complete sense of irresponsibility. Taxpayers cannot provide the oxygen lines to the businesses where you generate millions and billions of wealth. And you seem to be creating a kind of a labor market which is absolutely no structure and regulation. And I guess you live in UK and you must have heard the story about the zero-hour contracts in Amazon.
Mahesh. So, I will just add a few things to it, which is, if you look at Michigan, if you look at Detroit, look at the Rust Belt of the United States, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, all this area where automotive industry was there. Keep that in mind. Then go to North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. What happened there? When the automotive industry started moving to Mexico, then to China, all right? What happened to these Carolinas and Georgia when the textile industry moved to Mexico, then to China, now moving to Bangladesh? Do you see any similarity? It's almost the same thing, reskilling. It happened there, it will happen other places also. Like President Obama said earlier, that old jobs are not going to come back. And now what is happening, if you see the data in the United States in terms of job creation, the only place that the job growth was is 30% in data scientists. So they are moving in a different direction. So if you want to go against the wind, you may not succeed. It was acknowledged that train yourself, reskilling. Now, you had a very good question. Who should be responsible for reskilling? In certain kind of society, it is a social responsibility of the regime or the government. In some, it is your own. You're also responsible. So it may reflect differently in what kind of government you have. What is the social responsibility there? Ideally, it would be if it was employer's responsibility, right? Or somebody's responsibility which was identified. Can you identify at this point of time? No. But I'll answer in a generic way. What's going to happen is anything which we talked about, and I have a chapter on that, very interesting if you read it, repetitive tasks are gone. Shallow thinking is gone. Human being will do the job which is supposed to do. Because machine cannot have the deep brain of a human being. It cannot do the deep thinking. It cannot do deep work. Machine cannot. Human being can. So now human being will be pulled out of doing repetitive tasks, just replying an email, doing something creative. So in a way, I'm going to the extreme positive of it, that you are raising the human being to that level where it does the deep work, does the deep thinking. And machines do the repetitive work. So of course, reskilling. What will the way the data is coming in, the next 10, 20 years or decades are pretty dangerous in terms of jobs. In many places where you have unemployment, you need less people. Because it's, as you rightly mentioned, automation is happening. Artificial intelligence is coming in play. And again, I'll just relate it just for 1 minute to the Uber model. So normally it's a master-slave relationship in the business everywhere. Somebody gives command, somebody does it. Imagine in Uber when you take a cab from LSE going to maybe any other place in London. You think you're the master when you call the Uber? Yes, you, because you punched it. Somebody will come and show up. He shows up. Now, are you the master the moment you sit in the car? No. Somebody else is driving the car. And he will not follow your instruction. He will follow what Uber has told him and through a GPS. So now he's also not master. He will go only where the GPS will take him. See how the master-slave relationships are changing? Now, he cannot even charge you the money. Neither can Uber decide. It's coming through a banking organization. See how the whole mix is changing? There's nothing. Effectively, what is happening there is, Uber has got just an idea. So everything is disruptive right now. So if you see the overall, what's happening around us, let's be very, very open about thinking what's happening. It's distraction. Massive distraction. How many times an average human being is checking his extended arm, which is a smartphone? It has become at least 150 times. That's too much. And what it is not allowing a human being to do is a deep work. Where do you want focus? It's not allowing, whereas human being is now not needed for repetitive tasks. But the distraction makes him ready only for repetitive tasks. I think if you see, Hewlett Packard did a study that if you distract a guy on his work, it takes 27 minutes to come back to the same efficiency. Now the weapons of mass distraction are right in front of you, the Facebooks and the WhatsApps and all that. So in a way, the human being, by this, what is happening in the business, is being thrown up into doing the right thing, what the human being was created to do.
Hi, my name is Ben Hetzler, former classmate of Mahesh. A previous question you guys had brought up, which I thought was interesting. Do you think populism and state-centric behavior has a true ability to disrupt global business? And I'm thinking more so in terms of, we look at the biggest economies going into trade and tariff war, China and the U.S. While it gets a lot of media coverage, if you actually start kind of breaking down the numbers, it's probably not even close to seriously disrupt a global bull market. And if two major economies going into full-fledged trade war can actually disrupt the global bull market, are we kind of overthinking this state-centric populist wave that gets a lot of media attention, but maybe it's just global business as usual?
Ben, my personal view on it, and I've been wrong many a time, this one is, if things do not change dramatically, I don't think such things can disrupt global business because of how interconnected people are, how interconnected geographies are. Where are the boundaries today? I order something in sitting in Houston at my house. It gets to me next day. I'm shocked. It has shipped directly from China. It was never in a warehouse. I traced it in any place in the United States. Where is the tax on it? Why? Because there's no regulation on it. So either somebody has to create the regulation. So my take on it is the non-state actors, I become so immersed into those geographies. And second, the interconnectedness of people. If you try to restrict, there can be an unrest. People will revolt if you stop them from this interconnectedness. How about working? I myself use Upwork very often for getting things done. How many people on that? More than 10 million people in 180 countries. I just upload the work. I get it done next day. I pay X amount of money plus maybe 0.6% the company takes. I don't know who I'm dealing with. I have no boundary right now. So it's not only true for me, it's true for everybody.
So 2 points. One about the populist politics, and the other one is about the trade war. Populism, if it remains a message, it will not survive. And unfortunately, that's the case in many developing countries. Even in the United States, we have to wait and see how much of the coal mining and the steel is revived. The early results are not very optimistic. There are some very good signals coming from some of the countries in Asia. Look at the way Malaysians have brought back a more stable, less populist prime minister who's now 92 years old. We are going to see such churn in many other countries. Let me throw a little bit of light on China-US trade friction. Something happened about 3 days back in China. There was this massive import-export trade fair. It was not very well presented by the British media, except The Economist, which carried a two-column narrative on it. China invited about 150 countries and declared that they will bring down the tariffs in terms of increasing the imports of China from those countries. China is opening a completely different kind of international trade pathways. It wants to send a message to the United States that, look, we may be one of your biggest partners at the moment, but don't forget we have other 150 countries to work with. America has a lot of friends in Europe who are quite happy to knock at the doors of China. Our own country here, UK, has been going around China many times, wanting their investment in our nuclear power industry, Waterworks. China now has a business school 2 kilometers away from my school called the Peking Business School. So China is definitely playing a very interesting game, according to me. And don't forget the One Belt, One Road program of China, linking up all the big industrial estates of China mainland right up to the doorsteps of Southampton, connecting more than 70 countries on the way. And 52 countries have already signed up on the dotted line. The Western press doesn't report those kind of developments. And that's what I meant when I said that the fulcrum of the next phase of globalization will be very different compared to what we have seen in the last 20 years, which has mainly led by the American and the European global the multinational corporations.
Danny Kua, the LSE, had this shifting center of gravity of business already at Helsinki in the next 10 years between Delhi and Beijing, between India and China, because the growth is going there.
Mm-hmm. Question in the middle.
That's a question, but I wanted to work. My name is Ilan. I'm also a former classmate with Mahesh. To answer to you and also refine the question a little bit to my direction is the issue of globalization. I have some experience in working in emerging markets, and I've seen already what you call the wrench in the wheel a few years back, the rise of the AML. And all the issue of moving money around the world. I think this is an example of a true example of the rise of the nation state. I think if you look at the regulation of money flowing the world and the regulation of immigration, already governments are raising the bureaucratic walls. So we could talk globalization, but money is not moving around the world. Literally money, not business. So a businessman like myself, when it does used to worry about how do I close the deal, now I don't worry about how to close the deal. Now I worry how do I wire the money out, which means if the assumption is that the world is run by corporation and they manage everything, then AML doesn't make any sense. AML means anti-money laundering policies. Doesn't make any sense. It doesn't support the globalization trend. On the contrary, same goes to immigration, visa issue, Brexit. It makes no sense if you are looking just from the prism of corporation. Corporation wants everything flat. They want to move their McCheese from China to United States for $2.99. They don't want anything else. So on the ground, in the last few years, I've been seeing the trend of a lot of bureaucracy by nation states. Who is moving that trend? It's a whole discussion, but it's on the ground. So this is one issue. And it raised the question, where does it fit in this whole global... And I think also the voters, the average person, is forcing the politician for hostility against the foreigner. What is the foreigner? In the case of the UK, we just discussed the issue of introducing taxes over Facebook or IT companies or... I don't like the word IT companies. Global technology, Starbucks-based... corporation basically put all the cost base on the country they operate and basically wire all the profits to an offshore. So I think the populace is becoming hostile to a foreign notion. What is a foreign notion? It depends on the local politics. In the case of Eastern European, is immigration. Or in the case of Britain, is the crony European with their big governments who are coming here to ruin our life. So each government, each populace translated, and in the case of the United States, is the Mexicans. So in each country, it translates to a different enemy. But I think the populace is already pushing the politician to go hostile on foreign entities, whatever that may be. So those are 2 points. Yeah. Regulation rising already, which is, I think, a translation of the populace pushing the politician to support anti-globalization rules or laws. And also the local populace were talking hostile to foreigners or foreign companies. I mean, those are the 2 points. So how does fit in the global business basically trend that we grew up as a generation of Thomas Friedman, the world is flat. And I've seen coming to a halt, maybe not the containers, but the container is the next step. Anything but the container is already stopping. You may get the container, but the payment with China will take 3 months to wire.
Okay, Mahesh.
So what you're saying is, your question is, if the central regulatory body like WTO or somebody doesn't put regulation on the global business, countries are raising their barriers.
Yeah. Well, Brexit is basically saying we want to control our border. I'm not analyzing why happened Brexit, what's the reason, what's the agenda, I'm not British, but looking from a side, one of the main arguments is, we want the populace, including you, the politicians, the mandate, to cross the border. We want control to come in, comes in, comes out. This is a translation for me out of a fear, discontent. We don't like it. We don't like the foreigners. They're the problem. They are part of our problem. We want to solve it in cutting, closing, raising the wall. It used to be up to 30 years ago, 20 years ago, before the globalization.
So I'll answer this in 2 parts. One is, you said barrier to people coming. So what you're saying is talent coming in. You're not using the resources which are available at the right price from somewhere else. Okay, so that's a local government's call. And yes, populism is going a little bit with that. But it has to be seen how far they can go and survive without hitting the inflationary pressures and others. But your other point was very important. That global business can be a substitute for having a war in the past to fix issues. We talked about it. Let's say for Iran, sanctions. Which was the most effective item there? SWIFT. That's about it. So now you don't have to fight with Iran. You don't have to send your battle tanks. You don't have to bombard. You just use the SWIFT and you get somebody to the talking table. So these are the 2 elements I think about.
I mean, that's a very powerful question. in the sense that the world is getting divided, and the point of division, I would have addressed you by your name because it's a very good,
Ilan.
It's a very good observation that Ilan is making. The world is getting divided purely in terms of what people want to see for themselves. I mean, amongst the whole variety of these global organizations, there are some very, I would say, responsible, neighborly organizations as well. There are lots of these non-governmental organizations. There are social organizations. We want to come very close to them. We want to respect them. We give our money to them to be able to push their agenda. So again, the point that you are making is extremely fine. It's something beyond the commerce. It's something which is sitting at the interface of what is commerce all about? What is global business all about? And all the other questions that... And that's where, according to me, I mean, if I have to summarize in terms of my own understanding of the world, nothing but the leaders are going to decide the future of globalization. This is the time when leadership is going to become a very important trigger in terms of the next, and it's the sort of mindset of the leaders which will decide the next phase of globalization. Anurag.
Yeah, so the comment about payments and cross-border payments hits very home for me because it's part of what Muse does. And what I've seen within the fintech world is, yes, it's been a challenge, especially operating dollars, pounds, euros, and you need to be able to try as a business to do this quite seamlessly and effectively. And, you know, there's, I think, two big issues happening here. You've got the large banks, like the HSBCs of the world, that have 75% of the business current accounts that, you know, historically I had to go into the branch to make a wire, and it took me 3 hours out of my day as a business, which is somehow just unfathomable in this type of day and age. What you're seeing, you know, as a counter to that is that you actually have the FCA has a sandbox now where they're trying to make an environment for startups to address these issues. And the growth of some of these challenger banks or currency, you know, currency like TransferWise and how successful they've been, kind of highlight your point about how difficult it's been historically. I don't know if it was regulation that made it difficult or the large banks that made it difficult because, A, they're too big, they're too cumbersome. They've been fined countless times for their AML processes and not being able to control their client base, which is a topic. So now you're coming into this age where some regulators in some countries are actually trying to address that topic and make it easier. But, you know, to your point where some countries are putting up walls, where the UK might be right now promoting businesses to get started to help the transfer of funds and help businesses get business, you know, within a split second if they decide for whatever reason they don't want to do that anymore. It's very easy for them to turn that off.
Okay. James Klein, who is the co-author, pardon me, of the book, last question, comment to you.
JR, author. It's a very interesting question, and I had an experience just last week that I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts about the whole panel. I did a book event in Vienna at which I sold a box full of books, and I sold them in euros. I'm from the United States, so the idea was that the purchaser of the books would send me the money, no checks. We want to wire this into the bank account. We have the routing number. We have the account number. I go home, and I begin getting emails from the person trying to send me the money. And that is, your bank won't take the money. Give me the IS number, international, and, well, U.S. banks don't have that number. Okay? So let's try doing it another way. And we tried another way to be able to get it in. We ended up doing it through a PayPal account. So my question is, based upon this difficulty and discussion, what are your thoughts on the impact of this whole cryptocurrency thing on these kinds of problems?
Yes, go on.
So number one, PayPal's not cryptocurrency, but I can see how yes. But the idea that you can transfer money freely between borders, I think, was a huge premise behind cryptocurrency and being able to allow this free trade to happen without restriction. The issue that cryptocurrency kind of has to deal with is reputational risks, and that there's some type of image around it, that it's made for the unsavory, unbankable type businesses out there. And until that is able to change, it's going to be difficult for that to be more widely accepted in the short term. But the PayPal example is a perfect example of how businesses are right now circumventing the large banks, because the large banks are just not able to operate or provide the right services for businesses to operate. So you start using these other type of kind of products like PayPal.
Same answer. Okay, Lali. Jihad, personal views, it's illicit liquor. I want to see the face of the people behind these cryptocurrencies. I want to judge them before I deal with them. Unless I see them, unless I study their character, their purpose, their reason for doing it, I don't have much respect. But these are not professional views, it's personal views. Okay. I think at this point, it's 8 o'clock. I'm going to bring this to a close. As I said at the beginning, please fill out your feedback forms. They're very important to us. Secondly, let me flag up a couple of events that LSE Ideas will be having later this month. 21st of November, Derek Labort's book, The World After the War. It's a discussion of US-UK rivalry as well as cooperation after the Second World War. And then on the 27th of November, and this will be of particular interest to quite a few of the alumni here from the same course as Mahesh, the executive level international strategy and diplomacy, Professor Michael Cox, Mick Cox to the rest of us, his book is coming out in the third edition, that's US Foreign Policy, but the discussion is going to be focused not just on the book, but what's happening to US foreign policy. So that's the 27th of November. All it remains for me to do is, first of all, to thank Mahesh and James, who's responsible for writing the book, but Mahesh for setting this up, asking us to do this. It's been a great pleasure to do it for you. To thank Anne-Marie and Lalit for their contribution, their excellent contribution here. And to thank you all for coming. Hope you enjoyed it. Come back to another LSE Ideas meeting. Thank you. I'm always reminded of Oliver Wendell Holmes.